Major Vizard, Reel 6. We've just come to the point where you'd taken over some positions from the paratroop regiment.
Up on the Devils, and getting used to the reverse slope procedure which we were to adopt throughout the whole of our time in Tunisia. It's fair to say at this time that after Saguenay, the battalion became not ineffective, but unable to fight battles on its own. And from then until about April, we spent our time coming to the assistance of other units who were threatened. And in this, quite often companies were sent off independently. Johnny Preston used to make a joke about it because he'd taken over what really was the remnants of the battalion after the Saguenay battle. And Johnny Preston was one of those chaps that nothing could get down. He was bright and cheerful, short in stature, but lithe, and he had twinkling blue eyes. And he used to say, "Is your base secure? If not, send for 16 DLI." See, he was more or less farming out companies and companies to support. And we didn't really fight a battle again as a battalion until April at El Kurzia. But in the meantime, I got sent off I was withdrawn from the hills, but I was moved from one set of hills to another set of green devils. And the 2nd/5th Foresters have got into some trouble. They've had a bad time with mortaring, and they sustained a lot of heavy casualties. And the colonel and most of one company, most of the casualties of one company, were holed up in a thing called Maison Blanche, the White House. And I was told to go and get them out. And I waited till nightfall and moved up. I had a bit of trouble with one sergeant at that time, which was a tragic situation. But he said it was suicide to go forward any further towards this White House. And I said, "Well, we got our orders." And he said, "Well, I'm not going." And he was a very popular sergeant, and his views would have influenced all his men. They trusted him, as they should.
Can you say his name, or?
I'd rather not. He got an MM later. I can say that he was KYLI, but he was a fine fellow, and he was killed later on. But I had to send him back to the echelon at that time because he was much respected by his chaps, and if he'd gone around saying that what we were doing was suicide, I mean, they would probably believe him, not me. So we moved forward. It wasn't easy. We moved up, and we crept into this. On three fronts, we moved into this place. And, there were a lot of very, very badly wounded men there. I had stretchers with me. It was nightfall.
Did you come under fire during the move up? What sort?
All arms from the Jerry. We could see Jerry on the hill. He was up there, and we came under small arms. But they weren't really interested. They knew it was an ineffective unit down there, and they knew it was really an evacuation of wounded. But they had a go at us. But we were in ditches, dried wadis, and that sort of thing. And we got into this White House, and the colonel was there, and his headquarters was still there. And I said to him, "Well, we're going out, sir." And he said, "Yes." And I said, "What about your wounded?" He said, "Well, we'll bring as many as we can." But he said, "I think there'll be some that we can't take. We'll have to leave them." And we did. We came out. You can watch Jerry digging in. I could see the moon shining on the entrenchment tools up there on the hill. We got out 50, 60. Majority of them were walking wounded, but some of them we had made impromptu stretchers and carried them out. And it was at that time that we spent quite a while with the 2nd/5th Foresters company. Other companies were working with one worked with the Leicesters for a while, one, I think, worked with Lincoln's in a different brigade. It was really a question of using us as reinforcement, as we were really not able to fight as a battalion.
How did you react to this? It was your first time in real action, and how did it compare to all the training you'd done?
The training had been useful, because I got used to bullets whistling by me and over my head. What I wasn't used to was bullets hitting people. That was new to me. I'd only seen Bud Casualty, that was the fellow. But that was a new experience. Excuse me. But, it's a shock always to see a comrade struck down, but one of those things you have to get used to. And actually, approaching through towards the Second Forest as we'd gone through the village of Tamana, and we came under quite a bit of fire there, and I lost three men, and it was a shock to me. And I had to bury them by the side of the road, you know, and erect impromptu sticks so that they could be picked up later. And I remember pronouncing the burial service over them. I don't know whether that was right or wrong, but I did it anyway. Subsequently, there was never time for that. After the Second Foresters' evacuation, I stayed with the Second Foresters because they were badly mauled too.
What state would you say they were in? I mean, what were your impressions of them as a battalion?
Well, they were a good battalion, the 2nd 5th. They became the 5th later. And they were a good lot, mostly from around Nottingham. A good lot. They were TA, and I found it quite fun working with them. We went down through Uarada with them, and the whole of the First Army was slowly moving towards the Medjez. I can remember, it's confusing, but I remember we were under considerable aerial bombardment because the supremacy of the Mediterranean had not been gained. And by day, we were under Messerschmitt strafing and a lot of Stukas dive bomb. And so all movement was by night. It was impossible really to move by day because there were so many of these aircraft. You'd see a short hop across the Med from Italy, and some of them would be in Sicily. And it was 10 minutes or something, and they were on to us. And so you had to move entirely by night time. Logistics were a considerable problem. And I afterwards talked to our quartermaster, Bert Newman, who was, of course, a regular soldier. He was a veteran. He died last year, and I went to his funeral. Major QM, OBE, and a very fine quartermaster he was, too. And he had an excellent RQMS, Fred Gaines, known as Larry. They told me of their problems with logistical problems, and the RSM, Thomason, he also told me about his problems.
What were the sort of problems they were having?
Well, the terrain was very rough. I mean, there were roads, but of course we run into the wet season. People used to say the prevailing wind is in your face. It rained continuously, and the paras had the dry weather, and we'd got the wet weather. All the dust turned to mud, and we were ankle deep in this, and trucks had chains on them. And when you got as far as you could get by road, you had to get on to mules. Rations and ammunition were delivered by mule. And it was a job, because the mules were better on their feet than we were, clambering up these rocky paths towards the top of these jebels where troops were. The rations were mostly compo in boxes.
Could you explain that for them?
Compo ration? It was popular, They came from A to H. The boxes were initialed A to H, and each had different contents. The food was in tins. You had tins of stewed beef. You had tins of pork. And, there was a lot of dry biscuit. There were puddings. H was the really popular box because it had the esteemed treacle pudding. There were cigarettes, a ration, and there was chocolate in the box. There was tea and sugar. I don't remember anything else being in the box. Found that one. The compo rations, and the mule would carry two of these on his back.
And now, would the officers get anything different from that?
Oh no. Well, to all intents and purposes, we've all won. They were very well disciplined, and they all paid orders, and you said go and go. No argument. But I always took off my pips, and I always carried a rifle.
Now, was that right from the start in Africa?
Yeah. I didn't see any point in making myself a target. If I was shot, it wouldn't do any good to the company. You single yourself out. You do take the same chance as other people. So, we all mucked in together. It was very much a question of... there were times when we had a cookhouse, I suppose you could call it a cookhouse. It had a mobile petrol flame device with cans, and you could brew up and boil. But most of the time it was Tommy cookers, and they were in the boxes, Tommy cookers, solid methylators, and they would heat a mess tin so that you could get some hot tea. Hot food was necessary. There were occasional rum distributions. But it was about that time, and before we actually came to the second fifth, foresters, the colonel sent for me and he said, you're getting a new second in command. So I said, jolly good, I could do with it. And he said, he should arrive tonight. I said, well, what's his name? He said, Reynolds. Tom Reynolds, he said. I know him well, he said. He's Yorkshire Light Infantry, regular officer, Lieutenant Tom Reynolds. So I awaited this man. And we were high up on the top of the hill. It was a clear night. The moon was brilliant silver. Down in the valley, we got every evening a thick mist, which was, from where I was sitting, it resembled cream cheese right across the valley. And I sat there, and the chap was due to arrive about 11. But by 2 o'clock, nothing had happened, and I was getting very cold. It was very chilly, very hot by day, but very chilly by night. And at 2 o'clock, I heard, or thought I heard, a sound of falling rocks and cursing. And a few minutes, 5 minutes later, a figure emerged out of the mists and clambered up the hill. Tall, rangy-looking figure, gangly sort of figure, and well over 6 feet. And he saw me, and he made straight for me, and he clambered up the last few yards, stood straight upright, saluted, and said, Dr. Livingstone, I presume. From that moment onwards, I was Stanley, and I was Livingstone, and he was Stanley. And right through the war, and afterwards, we were Stanley and Livingstone. That was his sense of humour, Tom Reynolds. He was the best man of my wedding. Anyway, I was glad to have him, and we worked well together.
That was just before you went to the Maison Blanc affair.
Yes, the arrival of Tom Reynolds, who was known by the troops as Long Tom, or General Tom. He was quite a character. He was a man who had peculiar characteristics. He used to twiddle all his buttons off because he kept doing this all the time. He all fell off.
Turning them to
yes. And he had a button called Jarrett. And he Huddersfield, and after Tom and I had been talking for some minutes, Jarrett emerged out of the mists bearing Tom's kit. The word baton or soldier servant is totally inappropriate. They were the chap who watched your back, the chap who selected somewhere where you could sleep. Two men, slit trench, because in that way you had two gas capes to line it. You had two great coats over the top, and you had a ground sheet to keep the rain out. And two fellas, sort of some neutral warmth, back to back, sleep down there. And this was, I mean, this was the man that did that. He was the man who went and got your grub for you in a mess tin and brought it to you. And while you looked to see that everybody else had got there, as you see, and he looked after you and brought it to you. But no Batman didn't clean anything, none of that.
Who was your Batman?
McDonald.
Do you remember his first name?
Yes, John McDonald from South Shields. I still send his widow a hamper every Christmas, have done ever since. He was a great fellow. He was a bit simple-minded. That's why he got the job. Simple fellow, but very loyal. And he did the job fairly well. He would watch your back. And if he saw anything, he would tell you. He was a good fellow, very loyal fellow, Tom, John McDonald. I called him Mac. His widow is Maria. She still lives in South Shields. I saw her several years ago, but I always send her a hamper at Christmas out of memory of John.
So, any other characters you had with you at the time that spring to mind?
Yes, the Captain Sergeant Major was a fellow called May. Subsequently, received the silver. Yes, the silver medal of the Americans. He was a beds and hearts man. He was a Londoner, an extremely good warrant officer, but a territorial. He'd been a territorial, beds and hearts. He wasn't a regular, but he was a very good CSM. And I had a company called a master sergeant, was a fellow called Wilson, Nutty Wilson. How he got in the army, I don't know, because he couldn't have been 5 feet. If he was, it would be 5 feet and a half. As far as I remember, he was ranked as a fusilier. But he was a CQMS. Subsequently, he became a CSM and a DCM. Anyway, that was the.
Now, what would you be, just perhaps before we go, what would your opinion, what did its qualities did it take to make a good officer or a good NCO, and how did the division of responsibility between them lie, in action particularly?
Well, we were all divided into units. I mean, the section was the most important unit. The section, the corporal and his five or six men, because he would be the most experienced chap. There was the platoon commanders. What happened normally, I found, was that the platoon commander kept one section with him and his platoon headquarters, and he had the other two sections more or less on detachment. They were several hundred yards away on either side of him. It was a section that was important. Section sentries were posted. Not easy on just six men. But that was the unit. The section was the unit, rather than the platoon, because it was stretched over very large distances with very few people.
So there's quite a lot of responsibility on the corporals.
Yes, very much indeed. And we were fortunate in having some good fellows.
What made them good, though? What were you looking for?
Initiatives. They were fellows who were pretty worldly for their backgrounds. The majority were artisans. In my case, a lot of them had come out of the mines. Most people tried to get into the mines because they had an easier war of it. And some of them had been farmers. There again, some of them, most people tried to get into farming because, again, it was reserved occupation. But we had farmers and we had miners. We had artisans and towns. They were bright people. They were cheerful, most of them. And they knew how to manage their... They'd been previously in a position of some responsibility, either for property or for people. They weren't very old. I mean, they were still only 20, sort of age. But they were corporals, and they were worth their salt. They were pretty good. They had a variety of different. They showed you later on the most remarkable things that they knew. I was at a loss on one occasion because somebody dumped 40 live turkeys on me, and I didn't know how the hell to go about slaughtering them. But I found a slaughterer, corporal slaughterer. I go, "Oh, he's no trouble, sir. I'll fix them," and he did too. And it's no mean feat.
Now, so the corporals were important. What about the role of the sergeants?
Well, the sergeants were more or less with the platoon commander. A sergeant would remain with one section quite often, and the officer with another section. And then one of them would move to the third section, and then the sergeant would go to the officer's section. They more or less moved around with the corporals. But of course the platoon had its own headquarters. It had to maintain its small headquarters because that was the link from me to them, and from them to the sections. The sections were all important in those days, and I used to go around different platoons, and I would always go off to the sections, see them, nearly always at night time, couldn't move by day.
So you were the company commander. So you'd have three platoons,
and then each platoon would be about 30.
And what about the relative roles of officers and NCOs, you know, where the balance of responsibility lay?
We were nearly always, don't forget, in Africa we were nearly always in defence. We were never able to fight as a battalion. We were always separate company operations, not until April, when we came together as a battalion. Then the role of the officers became more important, because the role of the officer is much more important really in attack than it is in defence. If you get some really B-minded fellas, they're going to stay there. I mean, you don't need an officer to tell them to stay there, they're going to stay there. And defence is easier. But when you've got attack, then you certainly need your subalterns and you need your companies.
Is that to set an example as well as to just to yes. give the orders?
Yes. Oh, yes, very much. Move on. Yes. Sometimes you can move too quickly and too far forward. We lost one company commander, Major Martin, B Company, and he was moving ahead. He's a very enthusiastic fellow. He was moving through a wooded slope, and he got too far ahead of his company, the artillery, supporting him. He moved into the beaten zone, was killed by our own artillery. His son subsequently came to me and asked me for details of his father, because he said he'd heard he'd been killed. And I said, yes, he'd been killed by enemy fire. I didn't say it was our own, but it was, I'm afraid. He got too far forward, trying to lead from the front, which is right, but not so far forward as Martin got.
Now, what about the issue of an officer being popular or otherwise with his men? What do you think made a popular officer? And was sometimes being popular not being a good officer, you know?
Well, yes, you can get that. We only had one, as I said earlier, we had one lack of moral fibre. And it was a tragedy because he was the son of a colonel of the regiment.
Was this an officer?
Mm.
Was that during the Africa period?
No.
Perhaps we'll come to that later, but I mean, what made, you know, an officer popular with the men?
Well, we were in defence, and popularity rested on a number of very small things. I mean, if you could get the mail through, because the mail was more important than even rations. if you could get troops their mail, and they were nearly all those air letter things, you know, and if you could get the mail Corporal Neil, if you could get him to deliver the mail and get the mail delivered, because it came up the hills by mules, and it came on. But that was important. If you could minimise casualties, with where my survival training can be really useful to there, I would always think that's fine. Popularity was something that you gained. You see, I didn't mention this, but I had to take speech training. I took it in Darlington before I left the UK. I mean, why I, Bobby Ladd, you see, I alarmed myself up a Geordie. I had to. Communication problem. For the first 6 months of the young soldiers, I mean, they didn't know what I was talking about. And I didn't know what they were talking about. So I went into Darlington and I took lessons in my own time in the evening.
Inexorably speaking with a Geordie accent, or Durham accent.
There were several. There was Tyne, Weir, and Tees. And they're all different. Anyway, I managed it. But you had to be popular, and you had to know their culture. If you could sing some of the Geordie songs, it was very popular in the evenings when things were quiet. You had to do that. That made you popular. But if you were dealing with people who, right back in Mill Hill in the Middlesex, I considered alien, well, very quickly they weren't alien anymore. But it took a little while to become really fully accepted. It took the Africa campaign, really, to do that. Africa was very much a testing period for the 16th DRI. They fought that one battle, and they didn't fight again until El Kuzia, which was the entry to the plain before Medjez.
Yep. Before we come on to El Kuzia, anything else about the period leading up to it, which was, were you loaned to anybody else?
Yes, I was loaned to the Americans. Personally, the 2nd American Corps, who were, I think, around Gasser, down by the Salt Lake, they'd just arrived. They were totally green. They were even greener than we were. They were nice enough chaps, but I remember going to the colonel, and I went in my... We changed over to KD, by the way, at that time. We'd gone out in battle dress, and this would be in late March. We'd gone into KD. Oh, I'd gone up to Major by then, yes. A Company. Commanding A Company.
So what had happened to E Company?
Oh, it'd broken up into all the others. The Colonel had reorganised it. You see, we'd taken E Company, and we'd put part in A, part in B, part in C Company. I was now A Company.
And more reinforcements presumably had started to arrive?
Dribbling in all the time, yes.
Were they as good as, for instance, your crowd or the original 16th people?
I think they were just as good, really. They weren't all light infantrymen. They were chaps coming in from different regiments.
Did the 16th march at light infantry pace?
Yes, when it marched at all. We didn't do much marching in the Devils. The 16th, when it was on parade, certainly it did, yes. There weren't very many opportunities. I mean, they are limited to the major cities where they did ceremonials, which you could say was virtually Tunis, Naples, Rome, Vienna, and those sort of things. We did ceremonials there, you marched them.